Welcome back to Tangential Banter. Excellent timing, Jack. Excellent timing.
You're welcome, Ben. If you couldn't tell, I'm trying out a new soundboard. So we'll see how that works.
Our production quality has just gone astronomically high in the last few weeks.
Yep.
You could say it's almost a tangential curve.
Ooh, you could.
Reaching toward that asymptotic performance level.
Indeed. Anyway, I interrupted your intro with my awesome DJ buzzer, so please continue, Ben.
No, that was perfect. So, welcome, friends, back to Tangential Banter. My name is Ben Mao.
I promise I'm not going to abuse it. It's a new toy.
You're only going to use it for the remainder of this episode, I'm
If it
sure.
makes you feel any better, this is a demo version, so it has really limited functionality. And like once you play like 20 clips, it makes you start the app. Like you have to close it, then reopen it, which isn't a problem, but it's just an inconvenience. Now that I know that it works, I'm gonna get the full version, but I didn't want to pay for it
Okay.
before I knew it would work.
You could just wait for a boring part of the conversation and then restart it and reset your counter if
That's
it's
true.
low. But we never have boring parts of the conversation, obviously, so you'll be pressed to find time to do
Right now.
it. Wow. You gonna do me like that?
No, it's already you exit out and then you just double click the app on my desktop. It takes like 2 seconds. Anyway,
Okay, there you go.
we've delayed I've delayed us enough.
All right, well, we are back, and we have another topic this week. I'm sure you're surprised. So this is a topic that I had written down, but Jack's actually going to lead us into. So the topic here is around a shift that's happening in our culture, and you could say it's observable within the U.S. But I think also it's a global trend. It's not just US. It's really more of a modern sort of tech-based trend. And that is seeing the economy transition from being one that is based on maybe long-term sort of professional type of employment to one that's more gig-based or contract-based or temporary. And also seeing ownership in general decrease and seeing subscription models become the new norm for all sorts of things. So just kind of talking about a shift away from more long-term permanent types of models for our economy, for employment, for ownership to subscription, ongoing, more short-term basis type things.
Indeed. Should I start us off then?
Yeah, by all means.
All right. So, the reason why I wanted to bring this first, it was Ben who thought up the idea some weeks ago, and we put it on our to-do list. But then, as I was searching and trying out different soundboard options,
That's a lot of nuts!
Yeah, boy! That's what she said.
As I was trying out
It's
different.
just to be clear, are those all one button that you're pressing, or did you just push four separate ones in a row?
I just pushed four separate ones in a row.
Okay.
As I was searching for different soundboard options, the first one that I came across, I think it's called Voice Mod, which is primarily supposed to do like voice alteration, but then they have like, hotkey soundboard stuff too. That one,
Sure.
it comes with a free version, which is really limited in what it can do. But then it was like, oh, you can upgrade to Pro. And Pro was it was something like $5 a month, I think. I think they had two tiers. But it's like, I'm not paying $5 a month for a soundboard thing I'm going to use like once every couple weeks. And I thought that was ridiculous. I was like, why can't I just buy it the one time? Like you used to be able to do for a lot of software. And that's when it struck me. I was like, oh yeah, this is probably along the lines of things switching to a subscription based payment model rather than like say, by the way, I have COVID right now. So if you hear me clearing my throat a lot, that's what that's from.
Yeah, that's a bummer.
Yeah. I've been feeling like I haven't, my symptoms aren't, well, it's pretty darn mild. I do, my taste and smell are definitely, they're not gone, but they're definitely diminished. I can't taste coffee, can't smell coffee. If I put sriracha on stuff, I can taste the sriracha, but it's not nearly as strong as it usually is.
Yeah.
I had some like, what's it called? Not moisturizer, exfoliant, like that lotion with the grains of sand in it. It's not pomegranate, not avocado. It's got some fruit scent to it. And like, I was like, I wonder if I could smell
this. Apricot?
Apricot. That's it. I knew it was one of those semi-exotic fruits. I held up to my nose and I took a big whiff. Nothing.
Yeah.
Which is really disconcerting. It gets really weird, particularly the taste. I think the smell, I can, it's not so unusual.
Wait, you were tasting your apricot exfoliant?
No. Just like when you when you eat something, it's like there's no taste to this.
Yeah.
Not that it's taste, not like it's bland. I mean, like it's like it literally has zero taste. It's so weird.
Yeah. So I lived that reality for several years before COVID because, for those who don't know, I had a deviated septum that was blocking 70 to 80% of the airflow through my nose. And then I also have many, I think north of 15 mild environmental allergies that basically meant my allergy season was year round. And instead of having a few weeks of the year where I was congested, there were a few weeks of the year where I actually could breathe freely enough to get the 20 or 30% of airflow remaining through my nose. And so I didn't realize it at first, but over a period of several years, the combination of the deviated septum and allergies prevented me from having really any smell or taste. And there'd be a couple weeks a year, I was like, man, this food tastes so good. And I realized eventually that it was because most of the rest of the year, I couldn't taste it. Mm. And I've kind of described it as, it wasn't that the taste was gone. It was just that instead of having distinct flavors for things that I could associate with, you know, like a garlic or onion or whatever, I would just get, oh, I can tell this food is sweet, or I can tell it's sour, or I can tell it's bitter, right? Like the taste became relegated to just those regions in your tongue mm-hmm. instead of a specific flavor. And so, yeah, food lost a lot of its subtleties, a lot of its nuance. And it was just kind of like, okay, I'm having a savory meal or I'm having a sweet dessert, but there is no other clues beyond that.
Interestingly enough, in my case, when it comes to COVID, well, one, I do want to go back to what exactly a deviated septum is. So I've tried looking that up before and I don't understand it, but for anybody who's worried about getting COVID, or maybe you had your own different experience, like my taste is different. Tastes are affected differently. So as I said, coffee, zero taste, zero smell, which really sucks because I really love coffee. So when I'm having my coffee in my morning, it just tastes like I'm drinking hot, creamy water because I put cream in it and I could tell that it's smooth and smoother and it's got like some cream in there. So it's not an appetizing taste, but salt still there. I had some garlic hummus on pita bread. Can taste the garlic pretty well. What else? Sriracha, I already said I could taste. It's definitely diminished, but I can still taste it for sure. I think cheese or tomatoes. There was like nothing. It was really weird. But yeah, so your own experience with COVID is probably going to vary if you get it yourself. And it's one of those things. You know what it's like eating, like the tasteless experience, which I was always a bit curious about? It's a lot like experiencing snow for your first time, or at least how I imagine it would be. Or at least, you know, maybe experiencing snow for the first time of the season where you're not sick of it yet, right? Where it's like, oh, it's snowing, it's so pretty. Mm-hmm. Okay, that was fun. That was cool. I got my year's worth of snow. Okay. Yeah, you're stuck with it for another 5 months. Like, the novelty wears off real quick.
Tell me how you really feel.
Yeah.
I was going to say, one thing I've noticed is that, particularly with onions, during the period of time where I couldn't really smell or taste, particularly because my airway and my nose was significantly blocked, I was essentially immune to the tearing effect that onions have, right? When you cut them, I just didn't experience that. I didn't get the stinging sensation. I didn't get the tears forming. And also with hot sauces or spicy things like peppers, I'm normally fairly sensitive to that. Like jalapenos, about the highest end of my heat range that I'm willing to go. And even then, that's not very often. That also seemed to be dampened. So things that people were saying were spicy that I probably normally would not have wanted to eat, were still spicy, but I was able to appreciate the flavor more and feel the spiciness of the capsaicin less somehow. I don't understand how, but I did notice that was something that happened. So yeah, I
Are you
going
saying you
back
had
to
are you saying that you had an unfair advantage when we both ate those habanero peppers?
No, because I think the habanero peppers were before I really noticed that I was losing my sense of taste and smell.
Oh, really?
I'm
That
not yet.
okay.
I'm not 100% sure when I lost it. I just realized over a period of several years that I didn't have it anymore.
I'd imagine it would have been gradual. It's not like one day. It's probably not like over a period of a month you went from being normal to where you ended up at before the surgery.
Well, the part that's somewhat odd is, well, I guess backing up. So I got the surgery to fix my deviated septum. I had treatment for my allergies that has significantly diminished those. And so I was starting to recover. It took a couple months before I really noticed any effect. Like my brain had to switch back on the signals that were like, okay, there is actually scent and flavor data coming from these nerves now. That's useful. So it started to come back on, but it was like piecemeal. It'd be like one day I could taste well, and the next day I couldn't. But it wasn't because like I was congested or anything. It just was weird intermittent signals. So that was like gradually getting better and better and better to where I was pretty consistently able to taste and smell over the course of a year. And then I ended up getting COVID last November of 21. And yeah, since then it basically reset me to where my progress was before the surgery. And I've been slowly dragging my way out of that hole, also finally getting back to a point where I can somewhat consistently taste and smell again. So
Jeez, what a ripoff.
it's been quite the journey. Yeah.
How long was it between like, hey, I can finally taste and smell again to, okay, never mind, not anymore.
I would say it probably got above like 50% of days I could taste and smell in maybe like summer of last year, so June through August time frame. And then so it probably was a couple of months that I had it before it was back to almost zero.
Man, that's
But
I've heard like stories too. It's like some people they get their like who had COVID, so they get their taste. Some of them taste and smell never affected. And then sometimes like yeah, it's gone for like a week, then it's back. And then some people it's like weeks or months. And then some people it's like nope, I've just never gotten it back. You know, ever since they got it
yeah.
like 2 years ago. So it's like it's a crapshoot. I'm a bit scared myself because I really like the taste of food. I
Yep.
bother saying that because I know some people who don't really care for eating. So them, I can't imagine being too, you know, heartbroken over a loss of taste or smell. Plus, the same guy I'm talking about, he's always had a really off sense of smell, where like he'll smell something and he won't be able to identify what it is. I don't know if it's like his sense of smell is really off, but
Do you
I
think
don't know.
that plays into why he doesn't like eating food
Could be.
particularly much?
Could be. I think, yeah, I mean, it's also maybe like he gets full really easily and certain things upset his stomach, if I remember right.
Oh,
So a
sure.
mixture of things. I forgot what I was going to say, but so going back to the deviated. Oh, I was going to say the person I caught it from, who I know where it is, it's a family member who asked to remain anonymous for some reason. But I'll respect that. They got it about a week, maybe 8 or 9 days ahead of me, so I'm using them as my metric. Like I've been like, you got your sense of taste, smell back? Got your taste back? You got taste back? Like every day, because I just want, okay, I'm 8 days out. Let's go.
And that's assuming that your symptoms play out the same, but you don't really have anything else to go off of. So
right. I'm holding on to that hope. So now, what is a deviated septum? What is a septum, and what makes it deviated?
Well, you see, ureal septum was... no, I'm just kidding. You would be able to explain that far better than I could. A deviated septum...
Septum is seventh, I do believe.
So your septum is, and this is my understanding as it was explained to me by the ear, nose, and throat doctor, is that the septum is the cartilage that separates your left and right nostrils within your nose. And deviated just means that it's essentially no longer straight. So it can happen. I guess what that looks like can take a variety of forms. You know, it could be essentially still straight, but not aligned with the outer passage or the outer walls of your nose. So it's like a valve essentially that's blocking it off. Mm-hmm. Or in some cases it can just be like crushed over to one side or, you know, fractured, whatever. And this is the part that's a little bit odd to me, is that it's typically a result of trauma to your nose in some fashion. So like if you broke your nose, you know, or you got in a fight or something. And to my knowledge, that's never happened. The only thing I could think of after I got the diagnosis was that back in college, we used to play tackle football on either Friday or Saturday mornings without any pads or helmets or anything. And there was one time where some high school kid came out to play with us and he tried to tackle me, and he ended up, like, instead of trying to tackle me around my legs, he just like stood straight up and ran basically full speed face to face with me. And so it ended up popping out. I had a bridge in my front, one of my front teeth got knocked out in freshman year of high school, and it ended up knocking that bridge loose, and I had to go get it refastened. But that's the only time I can think of where I've really had any kind of trauma to my face. And that, even then, I didn't notice any pain in my nose. I didn't notice swelling or anything. And then I didn't notice any problems with taste or smell for like years after that.
Yeah.
So it doesn't seem like the symptoms aren't all correlated with that event. But I can't think of any other time where my nose has really been subjected to any kind of trauma that would cause the septum to be deviated like that.
Trauma, interesting. I wouldn't have thought that. I would have thought it was, which, I mean, it makes sense in retrospect. I would have thought it would be a developmental thing. Like as you grow, it starts growing not right. And then as you grow and grow, it just keeps getting more and like worse and worse until eventually you have to do something. But okay. Interesting.
I mean, I wouldn't say that's an impossibility, but to the best of my knowledge, it's primarily trauma related.
Huh. Well, oh. The more you know. Thanks, Ben. That's the clearest explanation I've ever gotten.
Wow.
And you don't even have the power of like diagrams and such. Like you go again, when I looked on the interwebs, they had pictures that they can point to, and even then I didn't understand it. So good job.
Wow. I've impressed myself, honestly, with that approval. Yeah. And I will say it's the way they diagnosed it was by taking a I'm going to forget the correct name, a scope of some kind. Basically a tiny camera on the end of a metal flexible arm.
Yeah.
And sticking that up my nose. And then the doctor was like, oh yeah, that's not in the right place.
That so septum is his... deviated.
It's basically what he said. Yeah. And for anyone who may in the future get a deviated septum, I will say the surgery was fine. I was in, I think, in and out in about 4 or 5 hours, something like that, from like check-in at the hospital to discharge. It was a 40-minute surgery, I think. But the recovery is not a joke, because the first day or so, I still had gauze in my nose. And so you can only breathe through your mouth. And it maybe doesn't sound bad, but it's just kind of like that feeling when you're so congested you can't breathe through your nose. And you kind of like almost feel like you're suffocating a little bit, even though you're not really, just because your breathing's restricted in an unusual way. And so there's that, and then there's like there's still blood because they had to cut the cartilage and move it and then stitch it back in the right place. So there's just, it's a whole mess for the first day or so. And then once they get the rest of the gauze out, get it cleaned up a little bit, it's just not pleasant for about the first week. You can't, it's like weird because you think you just had this minor surgery on your nose, but you're just absolutely exhausted and don't really have any energy for about the first 5 days.
Yeah.
And then after that, you can do pretty much whatever you want, except you can't lift more than 10 pounds or something, and your nose can't go below your heart, so like you can't bend over basically because they don't want high blood pressure to blast the sutures out. It's not like a major surgery, but it's certainly not something to sneeze at either.
Literally,
yeah.
Oh wait.
So, go ahead.
It's not the best. I'm gonna get a different one. That's not that. That's not the classical ba-dum-tsh sound. So I'll find a better one. But that came stock with the soundboard.
Well played.
Yeah.
That's just my vocal soundboard. Okay, so that was a long tangent from our original topic, which was laid out at the outset.
Yes.
So was there more that you had to say in terms of introducing the topic, or did you just want to talk about why it was on your mind with the soundboard subscription?
That was the introduction. That's what got me thinking about the topic. So I figured me bringing the soundboard on, we could use that as a segue. And because, again, where I noticed it was when one of the first soundboards I was checking out, like it's like you can go premium to unlock functionality, which you kind of have to because the free version was so horrible. So horribly limited.
Yeah.
But it was like they only really showed you subscription-based, like, you know, premiums or go pro. It's like, dude, I'm not going to do this. There's got to be something better on the interwebs. It turns out that there is you can just pay for it once option, but they didn't make it immediately apparent. And it's $100. I'm not spending $100 just so I can, you know, do stuff like or say,
I don't know. That seems like a $100 feature.
You know what? You want to know what $100 is? $100.
That's a lot of nuts.
Is a lot of nuts.
It is a lot of nuts.
It is a lot of nuts. So,
what was the monthly rate? $5.
It was like five. It was, I think for some reason, the numbers 3, 5, and 8 stick out to me. Actually, you know what? I still have it. Let me just check. Because now I want to know.
What I'm hearing is if you subscribe for a year and a half, it'd be worth buying it outright.
Yeah, but then.
In their pricing model.
So here's the thing, though. I wanted to bring this topic up, or not topic. I wanted to bring this nuance up. So wait, why aren't you? I want you to open, dang it. So there's two different, I think, types of subscription-based models. So the first place where I really noticed it was Microsoft Office. Because Microsoft Office now has Office 365, which is a subscription-based model. Whereas before, right, I have Office 2016 on my computer right now. And before that, I think it was Office 2013. So you buy that suite of Office and that's yours. You never have to pay for anything again. You can use it as long as you want. But the thing is, as soon as they come out with a new version, now that one's going to have functionality that you would have to upgrade for. Like you'd have to buy the whole new package. So the upside to 365, I think this is what I'm about to describe is a good way of doing, or at least a benefit of doing a subscription-based model, which is yes, you do have to pay monthly or yearly, whatever. You can't just buy it and own it outright, but you're not limiting yourself to one specific version of the software. You're going to get the updates as they come in. So as new features come up, you're going to get those. That's the upside. The downside is when they don't do that. And a good example of a bad way of, or at least a disadvantageous way of doing the subscription-based model is that picture I sent you over Thanksgiving. I think it was I don't want to get it wrong. Let me find it. Here it is. Mercedes the auto company locks faster acceleration behind a $1,200 annual paywall. So that is a subscription. You have to pay $100 a month, $1,200 a year, to get better performance out of your car. It doesn't mean that as they say bring out the 2023 Mercedes, that you're going to be getting an upgrade because you pay for the subscription. You're just, you still have the same car. You have to pay for something that is a software unlock. You're not actually, if you just pay for the car without the subscription, you have everything there. And you brought this point up, Ben. You have everything there. They are just going out of their way to lock out functionality so that they can charge you more.
Yeah.
Which Office 365, that is not the case there, which is why Office 365, that's actually awfully tempting for me because I use Office quite a bit. But
and that's one to me where if you are someone who prefers to stay relatively up to date on the versions that you have for software, if you were buying it outright every, you know, 3 to 4 years or whatever their refresh frequency was for a new version of Office, it probably works out not too differently from the subscription fee, right? So if you were paying $100, I think it was, or $80 for the home version of Office every couple of years, whatever that works out to a month, and maybe it's more, but at least you're still in that ballpark. You were accustomed to spending some money, and so now you're distributing it monthly instead of, you know, multi-annually.
Yeah.
But you're still getting the latest features each time that payment is made, basically.
Yeah, you don't have to wait 4 years to get better features. Plus, you don't have to bother doing the updating yourself, right? If you, I think Office probably isn't the best example for this because, I mean, it's just Office, right? If you have, if I'm working on 2016 and I upgrade to 2019, I would just, if I have a Word document open, I would just close it out and then open it in Microsoft 2019, Microsoft Word 2019, and I'm done. That's the transition. But that's not always the case. And I think for more, actually, for Office, Excel, PowerPoint, probably some other programs, formatting can kind of get weird between different Office versions. Like if you if you close something in one version, then open it up in another one, some things can be formatted really weird. So then you'd have to go through your document and double check everything. The 365, you wouldn't have to do that. Because as they, I think as they incrementally update things, it's a much smoother transition. And you don't have to bother updating things yourself. Now, is it possible that they could push an update that screws things up? Sure, that's true for anything. But I think if they're doing much smaller incremental things, that they are behind the scenes making sure that, because the whole 365 model is supposed to be everybody's getting these incremental updates bit by bit. We have to make sure that as we release them, that they're not going to screw anything up. Versus, hey, we're releasing 2016. You want it, you can buy it. 3 years later, hey, we got 2019. If you want it, you can buy it. Well, what if all my stuff's in 2016? Is that going to screw anything up? Dude, I don't know. Probably. Then do you, if you want to find out, you're going to have to buy it. Like, you know,
well, you could see support for the places where they were aware of significant performance impacts or formatting issues, they actually created a new file type, right? So like if you look in Word, it's .doc instead of .docx is how they distinguish between the latest version of compatibility from the, was it Office 97 to 2003 or whatever?
Yeah.
I think was the original .doc file. Or with Excel, it's the same PowerPoint. They added the X's afterward. So I think that's the only time I've really noticed gaps in the functionality or where you get weird formatting stuff is if it's between one of those two different file types. But if it's in the X file type for any of the native files, I haven't really noticed any issues between the older versions and newer versions.
I think I have over my years, but they've been pretty minor.
Yeah.
They've been pretty minor. And so, that might have actually been account to account differences rather than problems with like if I open something, if I save something at work, because I think work is 2019 or something, and then if I send it to myself and then open up my home computer on 2016, there could be some weird formatting differences. But I'm also switching user accounts, which have default settings and themes, differences and whatnot. So it may not be a year or the a software version thing.
So the subscription for features in your car, such as fast acceleration, is certainly one example. A couple of other ones that I've run into that annoy me are, number one, the transition from the Apple made from iTunes to Apple Music. It's still ongoing. iTunes is still available, supported for desktop use. And when they originally started, Apple Music didn't exist. This is back in the original iPod days.
Oh, yeah.
And I was like, I was loving the transition to digital with MP3s because I didn't have to have a giant messy stack of a CD holder anymore.
Oh, come on, Ben. So that's half the fun.
It was not half the fun for me.
Flipping through the book, trying to find the perfect CD to fit your mood? Come on,
no.
Man.
Nope, it wasn't me.
I would still be doing that today in my car, but my radio is busted and it can't really, like, CD that's stuck in there now. It's a good thing I like it, I can tell you that.
Well, yeah, so I wouldn't say an early adopter, but I was wholehearted in my switch to digital. And it's fine for years. I bought a bunch of stuff on iTunes. And so now I, over the years, built this library of thousands of songs that I'd paid for individually, right? And then Apple changed to a subscription model as they introduced Apple Music, which was fine. Except what I've discovered in subsequent years is that if I want to use the music that I have in iTunes on my phone, which is an Android, not an Apple, music that I've purchased, the only way to do that is to buy a subscription to Apple Music, and then I can access that library. And they even go so far as to, if I purchase a subscription, download my entire library to my phone, but then my subscription expires.
Or you cancel it.
Or I cancel it. Then I can no longer access that library of music that I downloaded. It won't play until I reactivate my subscription. So they've essentially put a pay lock over items that I've already paid for. And, you know, I guess in my eyes, own, maybe that's not true in the legal sense, but yeah, they found a way to make me pay a second time for items that I purchased, which I would say it's ownership because it's called a store. And when you click the button, it says purchase. So they can debate, I guess, over the technicalities. But the way that's presented or was presented to customers at the time, it was a purchase, not some sort of a conditional arrangement.
Right. Which I would agree with. I had iTunes back in the day. I would still be using it, except one, I only ever use it because to burn CDs, which I can't play in my car anymore until I get my radio fixed, which is not going to happen. And then... also, I rebuilt my computer, put a new motherboard in there, and then iTunes detects that as a different device, and it won't let me, like, I have to unlock the new device or something. It's a huge pain, so I just gave up. I'm sure there's a way to doing it, but...
Yeah, you can go in through your account and deactivate old devices so that it frees up, because I think you're allowed up to 5 devices per account, so you can deactivate old ones and add new ones, but it's certainly difficult enough to make... A lot of people avoided, I think. So, Apple iTunes, Apple Music, kind of that model change is one that I've found bothersome. The other one is that, and this is certainly, I'm not saying anybody's forced any of these changes, right? It's just that as each company tends to support the newer model more, the options and availability for what you used to do tend to go away. So over time, you're kind of gradually phased out, even if you wanted to stick with the older operating model. So the other example is having digital copies of movies instead of physical copies. And, you know, it used to be you'd buy a DVD or a Blu-ray or whatever, and you could also get a digital code with it, and then you'd get a copy of it But now a lot of it you're just buying digitally to begin with. A lot of people don't bother, or if they buy it at all, they just have a subscription to Netflix or Hulu or whatever and have the movies that or TV shows that they want to watch are there available, which all sounds great in theory, except that take, for example, so NBC content like The Office or Brooklyn Nine-Nine that used to be on services like Netflix or Hulu, NBC has now launched their own streaming platform. So they're migrating all their content to their own platform, which is totally within their purview. It makes sense in that regard. But it's gotten to a point now where there's everybody under the sun has a streaming service. And so what originally started as a essentially a digital library where you could go to one place instead of having all these physical copies floating around, you could go to one place and find any of the stuff that you would have watched on a physical copy in this digital library. That's now scattered across a half a dozen different streaming platforms. And then even then, there's no guarantee that it's going to stay there, that your subscriptions cover the stuff that you actually want to see. And so it's gotten to a point where a friend of mine, and I know there are a lot of people who do this, so it's not in any way novel, but he's set up a home server with a significantly large hard drive. And so he just buys digital copies of, or sorry, hard copies of things that he wants to watch or music he wants to listen to, whatever, rips it from the physical copy into a digital format, and then stores it on that hard drive on his server. And then any TV or computer in his house, he can listen to that from his home server. So that's, I guess you could call it an extreme, but one way to maybe avoid getting just sucked up into the vortex that is the subscription model for digital media.
Have we talked, so I, the whole, you know, what's going on with all the different streaming services, that is something that I'm somewhat passionate about. So can I step in here for a second?
Yeah, by all means.
So I get, I'm passionate in this way. I understand where you're coming from, but isn't this really what we asked, have been asking for ever, or what we were, everybody was asking for, at least pretty close to it back in the days of cable? Isn't this what we wanted? And now we're still complaining. And here's what I mean by that. Back when there was cable, you had to pay one giant bill for everything. You can either, and they did have different packages, sure, but those packages were usually pretty crappy. And one, there was a very small, there was a very few number of them, and you couldn't just pick and choose, right? Everybody wanted to pick and choose. Why can't I just pick the channels that I want to have on cable and just pay for those? So sure, there might be 300 channels out there, but I only ever watch five of them. Can't I just pick those five and pay for those five? So I'm not paying 150 bucks a month. I'm paying, like, I don't know, 40 bucks a month or something, or maybe even less. Then Hulu and Netflix came out. That was the, that was beyond actually what we were asking for, because it was, it had, it was basically the benefits of cable where it had like everything on there, but none of the disadvantages, where it was like $8 a month or something. So that was really sweet. They would say, oh, we have all the benefits of cable with paying for only at only like 1/20th the cost. Awesome. Everybody got thumbs up. And that's where everybody got spoiled, because as soon as all these other streaming services came in and gave us the option to a la carte our show choices, not as much, I think, as people really want, right? It's not on a show-by-show basis, but it's getting to be on a, what I would call equivalent to a channel-by-channel basis. Now we're complaining just because we had it so good. We were asking for the moon. We actually got the sun. And now that we're just, okay, no, now you guys can just have the moon. It's like, oh, no, but I want the sun back. It's like, but come on, guys. Like, let's, do we, did you really expect Hulu and Netflix in their heyday, where again, like everything, those are like the two streaming services, everything was on those two things, and it's all on demand too. That's the other benefit that nobody's talking about. Cable is, you want to watch Comedy Central? Okay, you're stuck with some random comedy special for the next 2 hours. You don't want to watch it? Too damn bad. Whereas now, it's like, I want to watch Futurama. I can just hop on Hulu and just start watching Futurama, any episode of it, right now. Didn't have that choice before. So now that we're not getting, so now that, but now that we, it's like, do we really expect that to last? Because I think what we're getting at, what we're seeing right now, is going to be the status quo, the equilibrium, where we are having all of these different quote unquote channels competing for one another. And we do get to pick and choose. If you just want Hulu, or you just want Netflix, or you just want Disney Plus, or say you want all three of them plus Paramount Plus, you can do that. It's up to you whether you want one streaming service and that's all you pay for because you're quote unquote frugal like I am, or you want everything. You have the option. And yes, I realize it's not as sweet as it was back in the heyday of Netflix and Hulu. Trust me, I miss it just as much as anybody else. I miss my Parks and Rec. I miss my Office. When they took It's Always Sunny off of Netflix, I was devastated. But really, it's just another 15 or so bucks a month if I want Hulu on top of Netflix. Which I actually got rid of Netflix because I didn't have the things I wanted to watch on at the time. Hulu did, so I switched. I've been on Hulu for the last year and a half watching all the stuff I want to watch.
Two counterpoints. First, I would say that, well, when cable was king, what many people said was that they wanted the ability to choose individual channels to pay for in their bundle. I think the actual unspoken desire behind that, if you think about it, like no one, at least that I know, watches, for example, NBC all day. And it's like, man, I just love the content I got on NBC. Maybe Fox is the exception. But in general, it would be, oh, I want to see show X on NBC. And then at 8:30, I'll watch show Y on CBS. And then at 10 o'clock, I'll watch show Z on ESPN or whatever, right? So I don't think there's anybody, by and large, who's so committed to a channel that that's what they wanted to watch full time. At least for the major networks. There might be some specialty ones where that's true. So I would say, yes, we do have the ability to select channels in that sense today, but I don't think it was ever about channels. It was about content that you wanted to watch that was on a channel. And so you would, we couldn't even dream of the ability to choose a show, especially because we didn't have the on-demand component. So choosing the channels that you had was the closest we could get. So I think people said that because that was the best they could imagine at the time, even though they wanted something better, which we did end up getting. So that'd be my argument number one, is that we actually got what people wanted. They just wouldn't have been able to articulate it at the time. The second piece is that if you look at the streaming services today, you still can't choose individual channels in almost any case. So if you look at NBC, for example, their streaming service has, I don't know how many it is, 4, 10 different channels that are bundled together. Disney Plus has a similar thing where they've got Animal Planet and Nat Geo, and then their Disney Classics and whatever. Like, it's content from at least a half a dozen different channels from a cable bundle. Hulu and Netflix don't really correlate to any channels, but they have content from, you know, the equivalent of multiple channels. So there's nobody who's really, potentially with the exception of like HBO, there are very few streaming services who are actually saying this is just the one channel that you wanted and not a bunch of this other junk that we've bundled together because we also make that content. So I still don't think we've got to a point where you can actually choose any single individual channel and just pay for that content.
That's true, but I think when I said, I can't remember if I put quotes around channels, but I think what we're seeing now is as close to an equivalent to individual channels as we're going to get. Because I think the idea of channels is going to go out further and further out the window as we go to these streaming services. Because look how many channels there were on cable. There were literally hundreds of them. Do we really want hundreds of streaming services out there? Even if we wanted it, do we really expect that to happen? Or do we expect people to say, hey, yeah, we could make a Comedy Central only streaming channel, but we notice a lot of people watch Comedy Central and FX together. why don't we just bundle them together and force people to pay for both? Because I think people, a lot of people would, because those are two pretty similar channels. Good channels.
Yeah.
What I'm trying to say, maybe the infrastructure to have literally channel by channel pick is just not, it's not there.
So that's what, if I was going to design a streaming service that would address what I think the gripe is, it would be a premium content bundler that would say, okay, you can choose content from any of these 16 streaming services. And let's say you want to watch two shows from Netflix and two shows from Hulu. Those would be available. And maybe it would be, 40% of what the, or 50% of what the cost of buying all the subscriptions individually would be. But I'm not interested in 95% of what's on Netflix or 95% of what's on Hulu or any of these other channels or any of these other subscription services. So it'd be, you'd be paying a premium for any of the individual things that you wanted to be able to view, but it would be aggregated in one place and you wouldn't have to filter through all this junk that you have no interest in, to begin with.
Yeah.
And it would, what it would also do is not have ads, which is another pet peeve of mine when you're paying a subscription service and there are still ads in it. That's insane to me.
I don't think it's, I can sympathize or I can empathize with that, but I still don't agree that it's ridiculous. Granted, I don't know what the cost breakdown is, or the income versus cost breakdown of these streaming services are. Like, can they make enough money just by subscriptions alone? They don't need ads. Let me rephrase that. Can they make enough money based off subscriptions alone without any ads while also producing their own shows, as a lot of these streaming services are now doing, like Netflix and Hulu, I think, is doing it too, but definitely Netflix. Some of those productions are, they're spendy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's because they're trying to capture eyes, capture subscriptions, right? But I think what we're seeing is an age where there's an overproduction of content because everybody's trying to get your eyeballs on their platform. And I don't think it's sustainable. I don't, there's just too much content being generated that isn't really interesting. The fact that it's called content is extremely revealing, right? Because really what we're interested in watching are stories, right? We connect with characters, with people in stories. And so content as just like, oh, this exists, something happened, isn't really persuasive for me anyway. And I think for the average person. But
yeah. Good point.
That's just the one element. I think, you know, there's subscription services that are coming in really at all corners of life, right? You mentioned the Mercedes. I'm trying to think of other examples, but really any kind of software service is, if it hasn't already, is like evaluating transitioning to a subscription model. I'm trying to think of other examples where hardware comes with some kind of a subscription. I'm not coming up with any off the top of my head.
Hardware?
Really proves my point, doesn't it?
I mean, I was thinking like rental, like, you know, rental centers, which always seem odd to me. Like,
speaking
when you
of rental centers,
when you can like rent furniture, it's like, you want to rent furniture? Like, it, to try it out? I'm confused. Or maybe,
or
I guess
you're
if you're
live there for a short period of time.
Yeah, but like, is it, are there really enough people renting furniture where those people can, those stores can, you know, stay open?
I think a lot of that came from when credit was difficult to come by, you know, like in the 80s. If you couldn't afford to buy something outright, you could rent it for $25 a month or whatever, right? So you couldn't afford $2,000 for a new couch, but you could rent it for $25 a month. And so it gave you the ability to have things. as long as you can make payments that
I guess
maybe were not within your means. But having said that, growing up, my family didn't own a TV, but we would, every 2 years, we would go to the Rent-A-Center and get a TV for the 2 weeks that the Summer or Winter Olympics were on, and we'd watch the Olympics with a rented TV.
Oh, that seems like a rational use of rented furniture, though, where you do have like a special occasion. I was also thinking maybe college students would benefit from rental furniture, because I know when I was in college, the 4 years I was there, I lived in four different places for reasons I won't go into. Just logistic, like, well, you know what? Tangential banter. Why not? My first year, I was in the dorms. My second year, you can't actually go back to the dorms as a sophomore. Like, you need to apply, and there's not a good chance you'd get into it. And I didn't want to anyway. Whereas as a freshman, you kind of had to be in the dorms. It's just really weird. Yeah, I don't understand why they do that. But yeah, so I had
to a lot of schools. It's to try to force freshmen to interact with other people and build relationships.
Yeah, forget that. Freshman year had to be in the dorms. Sophomore year, you had to not be in the dorms, so I had to find a new place. Okay, then I did a co-op or like an internship for a year and a half. So I just went to go live back with my mom in the suburbs. I worked for close to two calendar years. Then I went back to school. Well, then I needed to find I went back in the winter semester. So I started school back up in January. So I needed to find student housing in January. That was awkward. I found something, but I was living in a long stay hotel that a friend of my mom owned. So they got us a okay rate. But I did that for a semester. That's not a long-term thing. So I got out of there. And then my last year, so I needed to get out of there. Then I found housing for my last year. That's it. That's how I did. That's my stay in college or stays. Mm. So in that case, right, having rented furniture would have been not a bad idea. I didn't do that, but it's funny because one of the pieces of furniture I did have in all that ordeal, my mom found it like on Craigslist or something. It's a couch. Got on Craigslist for my last place. Then I moved out back to her place while I was searching for jobs and such and getting ready for my bike trip, actually. So I moved back. I couldn't keep the couch. Gave it to my friend. He used it for a few years. He passed it along to my other friend. He used it for a few years. He got rid of it and gave it back to me. So wow. Now I have that couch.
Full circle. I'm
looking at it right now in my living room. Yep, it's traded hands for the last 8 years.
Wow.
So yeah, it is not a comfortable couch. It's really just there for just to fill up my living room right now.
To be handed off to somebody else when you move.
Yeah, I might just leave it here. Although I don't know. Now it's kind of become like a running gag or like an icon, and I have to keep it within the family, as it were.
Hmm. So that reminds me of not the rented equipment, but I was just thinking about the subscription model for physical stuff again, and thinking about there's kind of this, I guess I struggle mentally a little bit with leasing some of the interactions.
Car, before we forget, leasing a car is an example. I wanted to throw that in. Continue.
Sure. Yeah. So I was thinking of, this kind of leads into the second part of the topic a little bit, is the democratization of different parts of the economy through digital tools. And what I mean by that is, so for example, Airbnb enabling individuals to generate money from their property by using it as a hotel, competing with massive multinational corporations, right? Same with Uber competing with taxi businesses. There's all sorts of examples of that, like, you know, Etsy being a marketplace for handmade goods, all sorts of whatever, right? Those are just a couple of examples. So I was just thinking about that in terms of they could have different operating models, because right now, I'm going to back up a step. I value the fact that those types of digital services exist, because I appreciate the employment that it brings to the local area. And it gives flexibility to people in terms of how they use their assets, what hours they work. It gives me more options. It makes the marketplace more competitive. I think in general, it's good for consumers. But even within that, there could be different models than what we see today. So if you take Uber, for example, it's a pay per use service, essentially. So you don't pay a subscription. You pay when you need a ride, right? So you needed a service, you pay for the service at the time of use. But they certainly could have done a subscription model. I don't know how well it would have worked, but you know, where you pay some flat rate and then you can call an Uber anytime you need it, or up to, you know, you pay some rate per month to get this many rides per month or something, right? So there, maybe that's some direction, something, a direction they would go in the future. And this is just me thinking out loud, not actually hypothesizing that they would. But on the flip side, we could also see a transition away from subscription models and see it go to a pay-per-usage model, where instead of having a subscription to Hulu or Netflix or whatever, you would pay per use. And again, I'm not saying this is a wise business decision on their end, but where you don't have to pay anything. But then if you want to watch Always Sunny, you know, it costs you $2 an hour or whatever number they came up with, right? So I think the allure of subscriptions is recurring revenue, right? It's very predictable. Mm-hmm. You know what your profit margins are going to be. You can plan your business very thoroughly. Businesses love it in that regard. It's like getting your morning coffee every single day. Like, you know how you're going to feel afterward. And so I don't see them interrupting that.
It's stability for customers too.
Sure. Yeah.
They may not like how much they're paying, but at least they know, okay, I've paid for the month. I can watch whatever I want.
So where that was leading me was the whole democratization of the marketplace would be, going back to the streaming services, is if there could be a digital marketplace for media where I could trade, you know, and say, okay, I've got a subscription to Hulu, but I only watch these shows on it. So I'm going to trade these other shows to, you know, Bill Snuffbucket in Japan, who wants to watch these other shows or whatever, right? And then
Bill's,
you could
Bucket? Where did you come up with that name?
That's a name we used growing up as a generic for like John Q. Public or John Doe or you know, Tom, Dick, and Harry. It was just Bill Snuffbucket. I don't know where it came from. That was just the name used in my family. Hmm. So anyway, the point being, you could, if there's a way to kind of barter or sell off the parts of your streaming service that you didn't want in a digital space, which wouldn't really work in a geography constrained market. But with the fact that streaming services are global and there's so many consumers, in theory, it'd be relatively easy to do. And it would actually set, a market determined value for any specific on-demand show or content. Right. Mm. Waxing eloquent.
I would say because it's so, at least on the surface, efficient, the streaming services probably wouldn't go for it, because they'd probably end up losing money, losing subscriptions, because, you know, you could have like three. Well, how would that work? Because for you to take advantage of somebody offering viewings of a show, you'd still need to have a subscription to that streaming service, wouldn't you?
Well, what I would like to do is get away from that entirely, where the streaming services would all pay, or sorry, they would all put their content into this marketplace, and then you would essentially pay for a subscription to the marketplace. That could be a small fee just to have the account, essentially, and then you would more or less bid for how much you wanted to spend to watch different shows, different content. And then those would be distributed back to whoever the providers of the content were. But that way, there's ultimately one interface for the user, right? You don't have to have your Netflix library, your Hulu, your Disney Plus, your whatever. You just go into the marketplace library and you could find whatever you wanted. And then you'd only pay for what you wanted. So you'd have one place, you pay for what you want. That's it. But I think, so this is just dreaming out loud. I think of a channel like QVC, or take your favorite channel that shouldn't really exist. And
great qualification of QVC, by the way.
So if you're not familiar with QVC, it's just permanent infomercials. That's all it is as seen on TV, like mostly kind of scammy type products. I mean, they're not really, but that's the way they come off.
And jewelry. So, the amount of
in jewelry.
When I was a kid, man, my mom would have QVC on what seemed like, you know, very often, just watching jewelry. So I just got this distaste for it in my mouth from my youth.
So if you put QVC in a marketplace, nobody's going to pay more than a penny per month or whatever, you know, some ridiculously low number to have access to that channel. But as it stands today, QVC's roll up in a bundle with something, and the amount of money you're paying for content you want to see is subsidizing the creation of content on QVC that shouldn't really exist to begin with. And so if you got into this marketplace model, it would, yes, there maybe would be thinner margins, I guess, in some senses for the content creators, but it also would help show them where they could eliminate content that isn't generating any money or that's being subsidized by revenue from the content that people actually want to see. So in theory, it should create a more efficient, more effective system for both highlighting what people want and what they're willing to pay for.
But why can't they do that now? Because I'm sure that they're monitoring how many people, like, you know, if you get, you know, Hulu, right? Or Netflix or Disney Plus, I'm sure they're monitoring how many people download and watch each show. And like nobody's watching our QVC content. We're going to have a talk with those guys because we're given the money to make stuff, but nobody's watching it.
Sure.
I don't think that they need to democratize the market to do that. However,
does QVC show up on a streaming service, or is it only on cable?
I'm assuming only on cable, probably for that very reason. No streaming service was going to buy it. And how do you infomercials are so, you know, act now based that how could you have a streaming service where it's like act at some point in the next 2 years?
Yeah, I guess that's true. I'd forgotten the demographic that the infomercials are largely targeted at.
What was I going to say? I can't remember. It may have had something to do with, you mentioned something about like Uber or Lyft, where, you know, what if they went to a subscription-based model? I think that would be a very bad idea. Because, one, they're limiting their customer base because they are, for you to even use them, you now have to pay a subscription, which is going to turn a lot of people off because nobody likes paying for a subscription. And then the people who are subscribed are probably going to abuse that system if it's something like you get so many rides per month. It'll probably end up having to be so many miles per month.
Sure.
Because I can see people taking advantage and say, "Oh, I'm just gonna take my Uber to go to the grocery store, or go to work, or go visit my friend 3 hours away." When they don't really have to, they just don't want to use their own car or something, or maybe they don't have a car. They're gonna use Uber as their car on the reg.
We did have a conversation a couple nights ago. I can't remember who I was talking to about. Actually, I think it was some coworkers about. Like a reverse Uber where you could hire a driver for long trips. So like you would pay their lodging plus some daily rate or whatever, and they would drive you in your car to wherever you wanted to go. If you had like a long family vacation or something, or
I don't know.
Like but
8 or 12 hour drive or 20 hours or something.
Yeah, and you just want to snooze in the back, or like you can't leave work early, so you got to drive through the night. You could pay somebody else to do it. But going back to that point, I certainly wasn't. I don't anticipate Uber moving to a subscription model. I think the point is, so subscription models to me, it's kind of like insurance in a sense, right? Like the tacit agreement behind insurance is we all know we're paying more than we need to, but we agree to it because we pay a little bit over a long period of time so that if we ever need it, we can subtract a large amount all at once and cover others who are doing the same. But there's a margin in there that we all agree to for the profit of the insurance company. Subscription services, in my mind, are kind of like that, except in the sense that companies are basically trying to maximize the number of people who sign up, and then really, to some extent, I wouldn't say minimize, but they really don't care who uses it if after they've signed up. As long as they keep the subscription active, the more people they have subscribed versus the number of people who are actually using it is a wider profit margin for them. And so I think,
unless part of the revenue is from ads, because then they're going to encourage people to use their service after having
paid for it. Sure. That's a good point. That's a really good point. Where I was going with that, though, is that I think that type of a model works well for significant expenses, but I feel like it's going to burn itself out. Like people, I guess I think, are going to ultimately go, I don't want to subscribe to everything forever, like a gym membership or whatever else. It, you know, soon you're going to have a restaurant membership and a everything, right? It just stacks up. So I could see it being more the transactional based or pay per use based, where you're paying a higher amount at the time when you use it, but you're not locked in. You don't pay anything if you're not using it. I feel like that's the more natural way for most of the things that we purchase or would use.
Which is definitely the way it has usually been. Being TV, movies are a good example of that, because movies used to be, if you want a movie, you go buy it.
Right.
Now it's, and most of the time, you're just going to get the streaming service that has the movie.
That's true.
So you mentioned insurance, which I think when I was younger, I thought it was kind of stupid or a ripoff. But now, as an adult, and I've thankfully had to use insurance very few times, and it's all been like auto stuff. It's actually it's really a win-win for everybody involved. Because here's the thing: worst case scenario. Well, I won't even put it that way. Insurance is you pay a amount of money that you know you can afford. Yes, there's a good chance you're never going to see this money again, but it's money that you can afford to lose. For the most part, I'm sure there's a lot of people who struggle to meet ends meet, and insurance is enough to tip them over. But I'd say generally, it's money where it's like, yeah, I'd love to not have to spend that money, but yeah, I can lose it and still be fine. But what you're buying then is, if there ever comes a time where say, oh crap, I need a brand new car, or my house burnt down and I need to replace everything, and including the house, I can't afford that. That's going to be like $400,000. Then insurance says, don't worry, we got you. And then helps you afford it then. So it's like what you are trading, losing money that you can lose for getting money that you can't afford to not have. You are for sure losing money that you can lose in exchange for, if you ever run into those tragic situations where you need a lot of money right now, you will get that.
Yeah, and I certainly don't disagree with the mechanism. And it's effective in many, many instances, right? One of the things I've been thinking about recently, though, is what if because I think what's frustrating is when you see the insane amounts of money generated by insurance companies around a product that is fundamentally I'm trying to think of how to describe what I'm trying to say here. A product that is
like health and like really near and dear or very valuable to people, like health insurance or home insurance.
I mean, it's kind of like you pay like with a bank, right? You put your money in, you expect to be able to go get that money back out. Except with insurance, you pay a bunch of money in knowing that you likely will never need to take out the amount that you've put in.
Sure.
Right. But knowing that a bunch of other people are doing the same thing so that if your moment of need arises, you can take that money back out. So it's essentially just a middleman for pooling a bunch of money.
Yeah,
right.
I want to say and
bank or insurance.
I don't think I can. I don't feel. Don't quote me on this, but I think insurance companies. It's not just a pool, and then the excess is the money that they get to bring home. I think they actually take that money and they do some financial investment stuff with it, and that's how they can make some of their money as well. Slash, have the pool be as big as it is.
Sure.
So I don't think it's as simple as more people have to pay in than the insurance company's paying out. I think there's more nuance to it than that, but I just wanted to throw that out there.
What I was pondering was if someone started, and I don't even know if it's legal, right? There's all sorts of weird lobbying restrictions that have created laws. So you can't do things you think would be okay. But if someone started like a nonprofit insurance company where, and it's not that the employees wouldn't make money, right? Or that the executives wouldn't be rewarded. It's just that there wouldn't be billions of dollars in profit generated for shareholders every year. It would be essentially they make enough money to cover what they have to pay out each year, and they have enough money to invest to continue to grow against inflation and, you know, against any kind of potential disaster where they got to pay out a bunch more the next year or whatever. But it's not paying out to shareholders at the end of the day. I'm thinking of it as like a, if you operated insurance like a credit union instead of like a bank, right? Where it's essentially any of the profits are distributed to the people who pay into it.
Oh, I see.
That's the mindset that I was thinking of, because fundamentally that's, I guess insurance is kind of, it's like a necessary evil for everybody to some extent. And so it should be operating for the benefit of the people who are covered, not for.
Right.
Investors.
I don't think it's inherently a necessary evil, but I agree. Yeah. Sometimes the way it's ran, it's, you know, geez, you guys could be a little bit more above board than this. Yeah.
And for all our insurance agent friends out there.
Screw you.
Yes, that's right. That's
good. It's all your fault.
I was going to say, this is not a personal attack.
I would say it is. No.
For me, it's more of the philosophical wrestling with a question of, is there a better way it could be done, right? Than saying this is awful.
Yeah. And, you know, I was thinking too, like what I think that thought has come to my brain before, you know, what happens, how would it work if a group of people just agreed to kind of pool their money together in case, you know, like as a de facto insurance fund?
Yeah.
You know, how would that work? And the thing that always sticks to me is like, how do we approve when somebody takes money out? And then how much? And then is there a deductible? How much?
I mean, I think you'd still have to, it'd still have to run like an insurance industry does today, right? You'd still have to have assessors or adjusters or whatever. You'd still have to have agents to help you figure out different policy levels and so on. But yeah, that's where you have to pay more than what would ever be withdrawn, right? Is to pay for the maintenance and the service itself. But I think the other comment I wanted to make, because I realized after saying, like, what if insurance was a nonprofit? Then there certainly would be a segment of the listening audience who would be like, oh, what if that's the government running the insurance program?
Oh, nope, nope, nope. Don't do that.
Well, so what I wanted to clarify is that I think in my mind, the nonprofit model is different than that. I'm not just saying give it to the government, because in my mind, a nonprofit model would still give you options. You could still choose to not get it if you wanted. You could choose to find a different provider who gave you a better deal if you so chose. And so that's ultimately why I would not. This is not an endorsement of a government-run insurance plan for anyone who is thinking that direction.
Well, we already
just wanted
have
to add that.
We already have government-run insurance with a lot of the healthcare system, and that is not one of America's pride points.
Well, and yet there's a segment of the population who'd say we haven't gone far enough, right? And if we went to the socialized healthcare approach of some European countries, that we'd be better off. So I was just kind of cutting that off at the pass.
Gotcha. I don't understand all that stuff enough to really comment on it.
Yeah.
But it's not good.
Well, I think we've milked the subscription model conversation plenty far. We didn't get to the point of talking about the more contract gig economy. We can talk more about that a little bit maybe in the future.
Yeah, but I forgot that was part of the topic, which is an interesting I don't know, phenomenon, if that's the right word. Yeah, we could have some good conversations about that, but I agree.
I think it can be a part two, because it plays on a similar thread, but it's a different idea.
It's a different manifestation, I think, of the same phenomenon. So yeah.
All right. Well, it's been real. It's been fun. So call it a day, and we'll catch you next time.
Indeedy.